Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast, which is brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. Today, I will talk about six of the presentations that were held at the European Society of Cardiology Congress 2022, which was held in Barcelona, Spain, from the 26th to the 29th of August. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
So the first study I would like to discuss is the AD4 phase 4 study, which is about acetazolamide plus loop diuretics in patients with acute decompensated heart failure. The results were presented by Professor Wilfried Mullens from the Hospital of Oost-Limburg in Belgium. The audience cheered after the findings from AD4, presented by Professor Mullens, which showed that an 8 euro per day drug improved decongestion rates by 12%. The results were simultaneously published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Patients with acute decompensated heart failure were randomized to receive standard loop diuretics with addition of either acetazolamide or placebo. At randomization, oral loop diuretics were stopped and all participants received high-dose intravenous loop diuretics. Participants had an average age of 78 years, the average ejection fraction was 43, and all had at least one clinical sign of volume overload, elevated natriuretic peptide levels, and had been taking oral diuretics for at least 1 month. Randomization was stratified according to the left ventricular ejection fraction. The primary endpoint was successful decongestion, defined as no clinical signs of fluid overload within 3 days of randomization and without any escalation of decongestive therapy. Secondary endpoints were a composite of death from any cause, rehospitalization for heart failure during 3 months of follow-up, and safety. The primary endpoint was met. 42.2% of participants in the acetazolamide group versus 30.5% in the placebo group were successfully decongested within 3 days with a relative risk of 1.46. At discharge, 78.8% of the acetazolamide group versus 62.5% of the placebo group had successful decongestion. The secondary endpoints revealed other benefits. Patients in the acetazolamide arm stayed in hospital for shorter periods compared with those in the placebo arm, 8.8 days versus 9.9 days. However, there were no differences between the arms in the composite outcome of all-cause mortality and hospitalization for heart failure within 3 months. Safety signals were not different between the arms, and the incidence of renal decline, hypokalemia, hypertension, and adverse events was similar between the two groups. Professor Mullens concluded, AD4 was the largest randomized diuretic trial ever performed in patients with acute decompensated heart failure. Acetazolamide is easy to use, safe, effective, off-patent, and cheap. It is therefore expected that the results of AD4 will lead to a paradigm shift in the way physicians worldwide treat acute decompensated heart failure. Next, I would like to talk about the SECURE trial, which is a phase 3 trial investigating a polypill for the secondary prevention of cardiovascular events in elderly patients. Findings from the EU-funded randomized open-label SECURE trial were presented by Dr. Valentin Fuster of Mount Sinai Health System in New York, and the results were simultaneously published in the New England Journal of Medicine. It is the first trial testing the efficacy of a fixed-dose combination polypill for secondary cardiovascular prevention in individuals of 65 years or older. SECURE aimed to evaluate the potential benefit of the polypill as a component of a cost-effective, globally available, and comprehensive treatment strategy for secondary prevention of cardiovascular events, as compared with standard therapy. Although most patients initially adhere to treatment after an acute event, such as an infarction, adherence drops off after the first few months. Our goal was to have an impact right from the start, and most of the patients in the study began taking a simple polypill in the first week after having a heart attack. The trial randomized 2,500 patients to receive either the polypill or the usual care of 3 separate tablets. The polypill intervention contained aspirin, ramipril, and atorvastatin. The baseline characteristics were similar in each arm of the study. The primary endpoint was a composite of 4 major cardiovascular events: death from cardiovascular causes, non-fatal myocardial infarction, non-fatal stroke, and need for emergency coronary revascularization. After a median of 36 months of follow-up, 9.5% of the participants in the PolyPill arm and 12.7% of the usual care arm had experienced a primary outcome event, which translated to a 24% lower risk of a primary outcome event in favor of the PolyPill over the three separate drugs, with a hazard ratio of 0.76 and a p-value of 0.02. Likewise, a key secondary outcome event, composite of cardiovascular death, non-fatal type 1 myocardial infarction, or non-fatal ischemic stroke, occurred in 8.2% of the participants in the PolyPill arm, compared with 11.7% in the usual care arm, with a hazard ratio of 0.7 and a p-value of 0.005. Strikingly, for the single component cardiovascular-related death, a relative reduction of 33% in the PolyPill group supported a clear clinical benefit. Findings showed that participants in the PolyPill group had a higher level of treatment adherence than those in the control group. The improved adherence supported the earlier findings of the FOCUS study. Good adherence may explain the improved outcomes of those taking the PolyPill. The results were consistent across pre-specified subgroups. Adverse events were similar between groups. The SECURE study findings suggest that the PolyPill could become an integral element of strategies to prevent recurrent cardiovascular events in patients who have had a heart attack. By simplifying treatment and improving adherence, this approach has the potential to reduce the risk of recurrent cardiovascular disease and death on a global scale, concluded Dr. Fuster. The third topic of today is covering the ECONET RCT, which is the first RCT to provide evidence for the use of artificial intelligence in daily practice. While tremendous progress in applying AI to cardiology has been made, no blinded randomized studies have yet provided high-level evidence comparing its use to standard of care sonographer assessments. The ECONET RCT met that challenge. The findings were reported by Dr. David Uyang of the Cedars-Sinai Smith Heart Institute in California. The researchers measured how often cardiologists changed the initial assessment by AI compared with how often they changed the initial assessment by a sonographer. The AI element made use of a deep learning algorithm called ECONET Dynamic, which was trained on echocardiogram videos to assess cardiac function and was previously shown to assess left ventricular ejection fraction, using information across multiple cardiac cycles to minimize error and produce consistent results. The primary endpoint was a frequency of a higher than 5% change in LVEF between the initial assessment and the final cardiologist report. The trial was designed to test for non-inferiority, with a secondary objective of testing for superiority. Transthoracic echocardiograms were performed on adults for any clinical indication and then randomized for LVEF assessments to either artificial intelligence or an experienced sonographer. The proportion of studies substantially changed, with 16.8% in the AI group and 27.2% in the sonographer group. This difference was 10.4%, with a p-value below 0.001 for non-inferiority and a p-value below 0.001 for superiority. The safety endpoint was the difference between the final cardiologist report and a historical cardiologist report. The mean absolute difference was 6.3% in the AI group and 7.2% in the sonographer group, with a p-value below 0.001 for superiority. In conclusion, Dr. Uyan said, "We were initially quite conservative. This was built as a non-inferiority study, but it actually met that endpoint as well as the endpoint of superiority, so we were pleasantly surprised to see that it was able to work so well. This shows that AI, in certain cases, is ready for prime time." Then I would like to talk about the phase 3 prospective trial, which compared sacubitril valsartan to valsartan alone in patients with heart failure and mid-range ejection fraction or preserved ejection fraction. Sacubitril valsartan is the first of the class of dual naprilysin and angiotensin receptor inhibitors. Naprilysin is one of the many enzymes involved in the proteolytic breakdown of amyloid beta peptides, one of which may be neurotoxic and is associated with Alzheimer's disease, for example, and concern was raised that their accumulation in the brain during sustained inhibition of naprilysin could cause or worsen cognitive impairments. Professor John McMurray of the University of Glasgow in the UK explained as a rationale for the presented trial. Prospective was the first randomized controlled trial to prospectively evaluate the effect of long-term treatment with sacubitril valsartan compared with valsartan alone on cognitive function in patients with heart failure and mid-range ejection fraction or preserved ejection fraction. A total of 592 patients were randomized 1-to-1 to receive sacubitril valsartan or valsartan alone. The primary endpoint was a change in cognitive function from baseline to 3-year follow-up. Cognitive function was assessed using the Cogstate Global Cognition Composite Score, which includes 7 tests for assessing attention, episodic memory, and executive function. Roughly 60% of patients had some extent of cognitive impairment at baseline, but at the 3-year follow-up primary endpoint, there was no difference between the two arms. Non-inferiority was established statistically, and this data was confirmed in all subgroups. A key secondary outcome was a change from baseline at 18 months and 3 years in the deposition of amyloid beta in the brain measured using 18F fluorobetaban PET and MRI, and again, no difference was observed, indicating that amyloid beta deposition in the brain tended to be unexpectedly lower in patients treated with sacubitril valsartan compared with valsartan. The trend towards decreased amyloid deposition on a PET scan is surprising and may only reflect a factor of chance, was added by Professor McMurray. Overall, Professor McMurray said there was no evidence that inhibition of amprilisin increased the risk of cognitive impairment due to the accumulation of amyloid beta in the brain in patients with heart failure and mid-range or preserved ejection fractions. In any case, he said, the absence of any negative effect on cognitive function is very important to remove concern some doctors had about long-term treatment with sacubitril valsartan. At the end of the presentation, it was asked whether valsartan itself might have similar effects that could mask any differences within a drug combination. Professor McMurray replied, if anything, the evidence could be that angiotensin receptor blockers are able to protect cognitive function. And this goes back a long time with the SCOPE study conducted with candesartan in a hypertensive population. The fifth study I would like to discuss is the Axiomatic SSP trial, which is a phase 2 study investigating milvexian for the risk reduction of ischemic stroke. Milvexian is a small molecule inhibitor that binds activated factor 11 with high affinity and selectivity and may reduce the risk of stroke when added to antiplatelet drugs without significant bleeding. Because genetic variants known to reduce factor 11 levels are associated with reduced risk for ischemic stroke but are not associated with increased intracranial bleeding, the rationale behind the Axiomatic SSP trial was to target factor 11. Dr. Mukul Sharma of the McMaster University in Canada presented the findings. Participants with a mild to moderate acute non-lacunar ischemic stroke or transient ischemic attack, 2,366, received dual antiplatelet therapy and were randomized to 1 of 5 doses of milvexian or placebo for 90 days. The primary efficacy endpoint was a composite of ischemic stroke or incident infarct on brain MRI. Major bleeding was a safety endpoint. Milvexian was associated with a numerically lower risk for clinical ischemic stroke at all doses except 200 mg twice daily, with doses from 25 to 100 mg twice daily showing an approximately 30% relative risk reduction versus placebo. Major bleeding was similar to placebo for milvexian 25 mg once daily and twice daily, but was moderately increased in the 50 mg twice daily, 100 mg twice daily, and 200 mg twice daily arms. Dr. Sharma pointed out that most major bleeding episodes were gastrointestinal and easily managed. There was no increase in severe bleeding or symptomatic intracranial hemorrhage versus placebo, and no fatal bleeding occurred in any arm of the study. Finally, I would like to talk about the TIME trial, which is a pragmatic randomized trial that evaluated the timing of antihypertensive medication. Professor Thomas McDonald presented the results of the TIME study. The smaller HIGIA study had previously suggested that there might be a substantial cardiovascular benefit of evening dosing of antihypertensive medication, and Professor McDonald explained that TIME aimed to test this hypothesis in a larger prospective randomized trial. Participants already taking at least one antihypertensive medication were randomized 1-to-1 to take their usual antihypertensive medication in the morning, 10,601 patients, or in the evening, with 10,503 patients. The composite primary endpoint was hospitalization for non-fatal myocardial infarction or non-fatal stroke or vascular death. Information on hospitalization and death was obtained from participants by email and through record linkage to national databases, and further data was gathered from family doctors and hospitals and independently adjudicated by a committee blinded to allocated dosing time. The results showed that the time of dosing made no difference. With a median follow-up of 5.2 years, a primary endpoint event occurred in 3.4% of participants in evening dosing group as opposed to 3.7% in the morning dosing group. The results did not vary in pre-specified subgroup analysis. Professor McDonald concluded, "Time was one of the largest cardiovascular studies ever conducted and provides a definitive answer on the question of whether blood pressure lowering medications should be taken in the morning or evening. The trial clearly found that heart attack, stroke, and vascular death occurred at a similar degree regardless of the time of administration. People with high blood pressure should take their regular antihypertensive medications at a time of day that is convenient for them and minimizes any undesirable effects."
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.